Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the Seymour Centre at the 2018 Festival.
I think we're here. Good morning, everyone. We've been waiting hours for you. thank you all very much for coming along to this morning's session of the Sydney Writers Festival. My name is Ashley Hay. It is my very, very great pleasure to be talking to Ceridwen Dovey this morning. I'm a huge fan of her work. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ceridwen as we go along, give you her bio if you like, but I am going to jump in now and I'm going to begin by asking a possibly odd-sounding question, which is what you think it might have felt like to be in Pompeii on a particular day 1,939 years ago when Mount Vesuvius erupted. How do you think about the heat and the ash and the panic of all of that?
Oh, yeah, I've thought about that a lot over the past few years, and often with, you know, it's a difficult thing to be imagining because the thing that always struck me the most when I was doing the research for the novel, which is sort of taps into some of that history of the destruction and then the archaeology of you know, digging through it in the 1970s, is how random survival was. Mm. And in the book, I process the histories of Herculaneum and Pompeii, and Herculaneum is a city, you know, sort of Pompeii's sister city. But just because of where they were in relation to Vesuvius, the human remains in each city were completely different and preserved very differently. And for many years, they thought that everyone from Herculaneum had actually managed to escape because there were no bodies found. Mm. And then in the 80s, they accidentally stumbled on a whole lot of these skeletons, and they were all huddled together down at the ancient shoreline, which had then been covered over by lava that no one even knew where the sea had begun and ended in those times. And that just was so devastating to think, you know, for a long time people had thought, oh, at least in Herculaneum they got free, they had a bit more time before that final surge came down and destroyed the city, unlike in Pompeii, but then to know that actually they'd all gone hoping to be rescued by boat and then had not been was particularly poignant detail. The other thing that really I tried to sort of feel my way into with the Pompeii stuff was who was left behind in the city. And so with the historical research, you know, there were all these theories over the time about who was there and whether Pompeii had been partially abandoned already at the time of the eruption. There'd been a massive earthquake 12 years before and then several afterquakes. And so some theorists thought that you know, the only people left in the city were the poor and the frail and the slaves and the infirm. But later research showed that actually that wasn't the case, that it was still a thriving town, which was sad in at another level. So yeah, there's a lot of sadness, even though it is such a deep ancient past. And I think partially drawing on that material, it's for me the creative challenge, even though I'm not setting it at the time of the eruption, but the challenge is how do we perhaps feel something again for those people, or should we feel something for them? You know, is empathy appropriate at a distance so large? Can we even imagine how they lived, or are we just, you know, projecting our own lives onto them?
I want to come back and talk about some of those things of, you know, what we presume we know about the past and how we kind of navigate that. But I wanted to start with that kind of visceral idea of the feel of the volcano almost, because so the book is called In the Garden of the Fugitives, which is the Garden of the Fugitives is one of the sites in Pompeii. And it is an incredibly it's a book that really makes you feel, you know. It's a book that as a reader, I'm not sure you could just sort of go along on the surface of it and not let it, you know, kind of really impact on you in a way. It's an incredibly powerful and moving book. I wanted to talk to you then about how you came to Pompeii as not just this sort of setting of some remove, and it's not a metaphor, but it is the very central part of the book's narrative. But how did you find that part of the story that you wanted to tell in The Garden of the Fugitives?
I started out as a social anthropologist, and I got halfway through an endless PhD in social anthropology before dropping out. But I had to read a lot of social theory in those years, which I still find myself sort of drawing on in my fiction. And one of the things we read was Freud's writings about Pompeii and archaeology, and it's not as well known as some of his other stuff, but he was actually a very passionate collector of antiquities. He had an incredible collection of artifacts, and patients of his described turning up in his office and actually feeling like they were entering a museum. And he wrote a review of a novel set in Pompeii, at the time of the destruction, where a man is wandering around the ruins and kind of imagines that he sees a woman somewhere who reminds him of his childhood love. And then Freud uses that to speak about the doppelganger, so the idea that there was this ghostly double that this character was trying to find. And then he says something very powerful about how Pompeii in particular is the ultimate symbol of repression, and how the human psyche can be excavated in the same way that an archaeological site could be, that, you know, there's all these layers that we as humans lay down over the course of an entire life that then actually become inaccessible to us, even though we've lived through them. And in Freud's take, it takes the analyst then to work in partnership with the patient to do that digging, you know, to excavate.
That process of excavation.
Yeah, your own past, your own, you know, memories and from those traces to construct. He speaks about the analyst becoming a constructor of a coherent life story. And I think, you know, whatever your take is on psychoanalysis and whether it's scientifically valid as an artist, that's just so, you know, there's something in that sense that things are not what they seem, and that we're all shrouded with layers and layers of self-denial and deception, and that somehow, in partnership with another human being, we can be helped to dig through and make sense of the traces of our own life. So that had always stayed with me. And then I visited Pompeii when I was 18. I've never been back. And the other thing, when I read that that bit that Freud said about Pompeii, it reminded me how I had found Pompeii really oppressive because I felt it was this place that is so overburdened with meaning. What could you possibly say or think that's new about it? Because it's two things that everyone, and there have been all these famous visitors to Pompeii over the centuries, and it's like incontrovertible proof of your mortality, but then also, you know, a sense of how persistent traces of life can be. So when I was looking for a framing for this book, I knew that one character, Vita, was going to be excavating her own very personal, intimate history, so just her own past. And then she would be linking that to her identity as a white South African. And then the Pompeii framing kind of gave me a way to reach a little bit further, you know, take it out of the present and sort of animate some of these ideas about how we, you know, present our own pasts both to ourselves, but also how we change those stories all the time, and that applies for both an individual, a nation, and an entire civilization. So that was, I found the Pompeii stuff helped me take it beyond what could have been more of just a, not autobiographical, but a way of processing my own parts of my own history. I needed a way to sort of feel like I was pushed to open it up.
Outside of that a little bit, I would like to come back to that as well. But I'm going to ask you to read a little bit now to sort of introduce people who haven't read the book to what we're talking about.
I'll just read a section. So the two characters in the book, Vita's a woman approaching her 40s, and Royce is an older man who's now 70 and ailing, and they've gotten back in touch after sort of 20 years of her having refused to be in contact with him anymore, and have started on this sort of adversarial correspondence where you're not quite sure who's in power. And this is a section from Royce. The temptation of any visitor to Pompeii is to look at the ruins as if they're trapped inside a snow globe, an illustration of ancient Roman life as it always was, the illustration. It was only thanks to Kitty's guidance that I was able sometimes to grasp that Pompeii was not timeless, but, like any city, always in flux, caught up in shifting currents of politics and style, opinion and preference. An example of what I mean. At the time of its final destruction by Vesuvius, the city of Pompeii was still reeling from a devastating earthquake nearly two decades before, in AD 62. This earthquake had strongly influenced, of all things, home decoration in the years following. Some people tried to emulate the latest styles of Nero's Rome when rebuilding their houses. On interior walls, they had theatrical paintings done in vivid colours with fantastical images, what Kitty described as illusionistic effects suddenly in vogue. Other families, unable to afford the new styles, or perhaps unaware of or unmoved by them, were left behind by the changing fashion. Little did they know that this minor failure of taste or economy would be documented forever. There was something poignant to me in this detail. It seemed embarrassingly revealing. It was like me being caught today, if Boston were covered with lava, with my landline still in place, probably one of the few left in my neighbourhood, a marker for all future observers of my antiquated ways. People would notice that I had not managed to keep up with the pace of change in the very culture in which I lived. I hadn't known about the earthquake of AD 62 until Kitty took me to see an excavated public temple rebuilt after the quake, which showed an artist's impression of what happened that day. Carved into the marble relief was a panorama of catastrophe, the Porta del Vesuvio collapsing, a cart pulled by two donkeys suspended in midair, the Temple of Jupiter already toppled. The inhabitants of the city who decided to stay and rebuild had created new shrines in penance for bringing the natural disaster upon themselves and gave thanks for having survived it. 17 years passed in peace. The people of Pompeii moved on with their lives. How could they have known what lay in store for them? They believed the very worst had already happened. Yet the earthquake held signs of the obliterating nightmare still to come. The ancients reported that a flock of 600 sheep had perished on the slopes of Vesuvius, poisoned by the carbon dioxide emitted as the earth shifted, as the volcano slowly, slowly prepared for its next major eruption. Clues to your own demise are more plentiful than you might think. The people who founded Pompeii had built their settlement on a prehistoric lava flow from the same volcano that was fated to bury the place forever. The city walls traced the edge of that lava stream, giving the hill town its oval shape and tilting aspect, starting high at the Porta del Vesuvio and sloping down to the Porta di Stabia. The founders chose to build their city as compactly as possible so that it could be defended against human threats. Meanwhile, the real threat loomed above them, its reassuringly green slopes planted with vineyards in quinquanx formation, pleasing to gaze upon. Some years ago, there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland, which I watched on the news. No humans died, I don't believe, but there was a mass extinction of birds poisoned by the layer of carbon dioxide that settled just above the ground. All except the seagulls, who were taller than the sparrows and the snow buntings and could keep their heads above that thin layer of gas. It seemed an important message about how to survive in this world. Keep your head up or suffocate. How random the judgment between those who are spared and those whose time has come.
Thank you. So this novel, as you said, is a correspondence between a student and a mentor, a student and her mentor. Years later, the relationship has gone a little bit sour along the way. And it's an email correspondence. So we sit very, very closely to Vita, who was the student and is a filmmaker and anthropologist, and Royce, who's been not just a mentor but a pretty extraordinary benefactor as well. And he's the older ailing man. And we're really inside what they want to tell us of mm-hmm. their stories, what they want to remind themselves or each other of, or sort of clarify. Can you talk to us a little bit about these two people in particular? Their voices are very distinct. You always know precisely whose chapter you're in, so where they sprang from and how you sort of navigated the discovery of both of them.
To answer the first part of the question about the email correspondence and why I chose it, you know, to be epistolary in form, but as we said in an earlier discussion, that they soon sort of drop the reference to it being emails and the letters are very formal. And to me, there was something about the erotic possibilities of letter writing that was very appealing to me. When I had read the 2006 re-release of Chris Krause's novel I Love Dick, it's always awkward saying that out loud, which if you haven't read it, I think she was out last year the festival. Yep. And if you haven't read it, it's amazing. But I found reading, that's written also as a correspondence, sort of a one-sided correspondence, but and she spoke about, in interviews about that book, about how erotic letter writing is, and that it's two people who are, it's a sort of a game of words, but also two people who are erecting a self between them. So there's the battle of the selves, essentially, that's happening, you know, right in front of your face. So I loved that sense of making them into, you know, protagonist and antagonist and worthy of each other. You know, then neither of them is going to give the other one any ground. And they needed to also be able to point out each other's fictions around their own selves. In terms of the why these characters, there's a twist in the book that makes it difficult to answer that question.
Yes.
Because, about three quarters of the way in, there's sort of two ways you can read the book, and I won't give it away, but the psychoanalytic framework as well, so that sense that by setting them up with this call and response, it's also mimicking that relationship between, an analyst and a patient, which is obviously a therapeutic relationship, and here it's something much darker. But that sense, again, that we can only perhaps make sense of our past in community, you know, in a kind of intersubjective communication within another human being, another mind.
Did they sort of suggest, you know, as you found a piece of Vita, was a piece of Royce suggested that would sort of refracted or impacted on a way? Did they sort of build each other in that?
Yeah, definitely. And there, Royce has a tendency to be quite melodramatic.
Yes, he does.
And I definitely had fun with that, you know, because I think often it would be the female who would be made into the melodramatic character. So it was great to create a male character who was sort of a bit out there. I mean, he's larger than life, and there's a reason for that, and there's sort of a reason for the melodrama that, again, I can't give away.
You just have to read the book. The other thing that struck me about both of the stories, both the story that you learn about Royce and the story that you learn about Vita, is both of them contain these sort of extraordinary tracts of loneliness and guilt, which maybe, you know, comes into those ideas of penance that you mentioned in the reading that you did. And the intimacy of the email exchange give those stories almost just a kind of a poetry. I think it's one of the things that really draws us in as readers. It's one of the things that compels you to find out just exactly where you are and what's going on. Were those ideas of loneliness and guilt, were those emotions a sort of conscious starting point for the book? Were they material that you, you know, you knew you wanted to sort of somehow work with as you found the story?
Yeah, I mean, the guilt would be definitely the animating everything of the book. I had never written anything that approached my own biography. And I started quite young as a writer, so I've been sort of, you know, working at the craft for 15 years now. And I had realised that there was something I was always sort of writing around, and that if I didn't look at, you know, base on, that there was always going to be a sort of a sense of an absence in my books. And similar to Vita, Vita is a filmmaker in the book, but she's really blocked because she cannot process her own past. She doesn't know what speaking position to take. She's not sure. As an artist, you know, you have to take a speaking position, right? It's that sense of you are, and it's a position of power and authority to speak in any form, even in fiction. But because of her personal history as somebody who is a class, part of a class of perpetrators, so as a white South African who, you know, certainly wasn't a victim of that regime, wasn't quite a perpetrator either, but was, you know, part of that grey area of beneficiary, she is unsure where to speak from. And what happens in the book is that what she is seeking is actually a language, a better language for her emotion and her the different qualities of her guilt. And so through therapy that she goes through later in the book, she's actually given a vocabulary for guilt, a much richer sort of almost like a taxonomy of, you know, the difference between guilt and shame and chronic guilt, and the guilt of an individual versus the guilt of a nation, and whether a country can be considered to be in the Freudian framework just as repressed and, you know, using the same sorts of social defence mechanisms and dealing or suppressing its own shame about its past as an individual. So all of those things were something in my own life I needed to find the right words for them, and I could only find them in the form of a novel because it is such a an open form. You know, it's open to, I keep saying with novels, it's the freedom to fail that I find so valuable in that form. And so I could only really speak about my own personal stuff, you know, in that form. So if I'm asked about it, I don't really know what to say in my capacity as, you know, a person. But through the form of a novel, there's something, you can kind of take a step back and hopefully find a more poetic way to come at these things.
I think one of the things that I found most moving about the book and about the sort of the way the mechanics of the book intersected with the narrative of the book is the lovely image of the fugitives. So you can visit Pompeii and you can see these 13 bodies that were, or these 13 people who were, you know, caught in one garden. But it's not the actual bodies, it's this hollowed out space in the lava that was then in the 19th century sort of filled up to create the forms of the people. So it's this lovely idea of we think we're seeing the bodies, we think we're seeing the people, but we're seeing a much later filling in of that negative space in a way. And there's a horrible tendency, because we often, you know, tend to kind of shorthand to draw a very straight line between an author's biography and a character, and, you know, you can match up particular points between what we can read about you and what we can read about Vita. But I had this sense of, you know, you going through a process that was perhaps almost like that, of there being this space that was sort of your life, and you then filling it with different things to see who Vita might be and who Vita might become. And that, I think, is part of what animates her and, you know, and gives her that power. That must have been an incredibly different process, like you say, compared to the work you'd done in Bloodkin and the work you'd done in Only the Animals. Did you enjoy it, or was it not so much fun?
Oh no, I loved it. But only because I guess I love writing, and I think again the challenge for me was to find the right form.
Mm.
So I felt liberated by that. So as you say, that idea of, you know, in Pompeii they actually would pour plaster of Paris into these weird holes in the ground. They didn't know what they were, and then they'd chip away the ash, and then the form of the human was revealed.
Mm.
And for me, there is something about making an artifact of your own life experience. It's not the whole truth, but it's like you've managed to paralyze something in a moment, and by then being able to hold it up to the light and inspect it, you're somehow free of it.
Mm.
I love something that Elena Ferrante, the Italian author, whose identity is now out, unfortunately, she says, you know, I wrote my books to be free of them, not to be their prisoner.
Mm.
And that's why she doesn't do any of this stuff. You know, she was much smarter than the rest of us. But I think it is, it's really for me, that is outside of me. And she speaks about the difficulty pleasure of the writing process, and that once it's done and once that book is sealed off there as an artifact, you actually need to have distance from it to regain wholeness, you know, as the author, and to let it not, you know, be your jailer anymore. You know, the image of the casts is so evocative, and you know, many of you might have been to Pompeii and you can see these 13 casts. They were only discovered in 1961, and what was unusual is that it was the first time 13 bodies had been found together where they lay. Usually it was an individual cast, so they had no sense of, you know, who had died around them.
Mm.
And it is like a tableau more moving than any sculptor could come up with. And right from when they were created, there was debate around whether they should be seen as art objects or scientific evidence.
Mm.
And one of the people whose research I drew very heavily on in this book is actually an Australian archaeologist called Estelle Laser. She's still doing really pioneering work in the human remains of Pompeii. And she went to Pompeii in the 80s and discovered all these skeletons that had just been stored in a jumbled heap in the Sarno baths. And no one had ever seen any worth in them, any scholarly worth. Because everyone in Pompeii had been so focused on the casts.
Right.
And when you make the cast, the bones get embedded within the cast. So they might be inside, but you wouldn't be able to access them because you'd have to destroy the cast. Mm. And the skeletons had only ever been used as sort of macabre props over the years. So in the 19th century, if a dignitary was visiting the site, the workers would get a skeleton and pose it, you know, for maximum emotional effect, like over a cradle, like reaching for the handle of the door, or lovers embracing, and then they'd cover
lovely
it.
Fictions.
And then they'd cover it all up again, and then they'd, you know, excavate it, and the visiting dignitary would...
Could be amazed.
Or was amazed, you know. So she was very critical right from the beginning of her research of the storytelling approach that the casts had set off in terms of how we interpreted the past in Pompeii. She felt that the way that the casts were spoken about, they were often given names and identities and backstories, and this was by the superintendents of Pompeii, so, you know, the men who were at the top of the bureaucracy within this site, very powerful men. They would speak about these castes and come up with, you know, that they were, these ones were, you know, a prostitute visiting a soldier in the barracks, and, you know, this was the final, the last guard standing at the gates, and this was a merchant, and he's kneeling up because he was looking for his son, and you know, it was very, they were trying to humanize these long dead figures, and there's, you know, something to be said for that, but in Laser's opinion, there was no scientific evidence to prove any of that stuff, but she could look at the actual bones and use forensic methods to actually find out what who those people were. And so she was really instrumental in proving, for example, that it wasn't just the sick and infirm who'd been left behind in Pompeii. She showed it was an equal distribution of men and women. There'd been a very popular theory by a very eminent Italian archaeologist right up until the 70s that more women than men would have stayed behind in Pompeii because they were so attached to their jewellery. And they didn't want to leave it. So she proved that, you know, fairly equal distribution of men and women, so the men didn't want to leave their jewels either. And so I found her intervention really interesting because it is about, you know, the toggling that we tend to do in historical discourse between should we keep the past familiar, should we try to humanise those people and say nothing much separates them from us, or is it better and more respectful of human difference to keep them strange and admit that they are alien to us and that we have no way of, you know, feeling our way back into who they were or how their minds and emotions were ordered. She's still doing work now. She also spearheaded X-raying some of the casts. So, you know, to find out, you know, they had stories around the casts and then they'd X-ray them to see the bones and they'd show, for example, that, you know, someone who was thought to be a pregnant woman was actually just a very portly man. So it's interesting. She you know, really was trying to push back against a certain way of using imagination and intuition and empathy and saying, you know, we have to admit that archaeology is a science of conjecture and that we are trying to tie up all these loose ends into these beautiful narratives, yes, which gives us closure. But is that doing violence to those actual people in the past?
And it's all such a fabulous metaphor for the, you know, the kind of craft of fiction as well. You know, it gives this beautiful sort of bigger structure for the book and what the book is, you know, and it's interested in doing.
Totally. And it's a question that, you know, so many of us as novelists are concerned with. You know, I wouldn't call this historical fiction, but it is, it's still drawing on historical research and inspired by it. And so after I was reading Estelle Lazer's stuff, I actually found myself reading Inga Clendinnen, the Australian historian who passed away a few years ago. And I've used an epigraph from her memoir because it, yeah, that debate between her and Kate Grenville, I think it was 2006, most of you would remember. And I wish it hadn't been framed the way it was as a battle, because I actually think it was two women at the top of their intellectual games having a fascinating discussion about, this was after The Secret River, Kate Grenville's acclaimed novel, was published, and Clendinnen, I think, you know, tried to start a discussion about what is the moral pact, what's the difference between the moral pact that a historian has with the past and that a novelist has with the past. And in her view, historians do have a moral pact with the past, but novelists have a pact only with their readers to delight them. So it's very different, you know, ethical project. Whereas, you know, Kate Grenville was saying there are the novelist's tool set of empathy, intuition and the imagination can access something about the past. We don't know what it is, but she also acknowledged, of course, when novelists turn to using history, we do what she called wonderfully smash and grab raids on the past and we just take
the
suits
bits
us,
that we,
you know,
need. Yeah.
No concern for anybody else. I think they're both right, and it's certainly something, I don't know which way, I go both ways, you know, even in one work I find myself wondering about these things, and it does come back to that question of empathy. I think at the moment we think of fiction writers as always being, having a kind of moral message, you know, in a post-religious world, it's like we've become the sort of priests of the age, we must diagnose what's wrong.
That's right, we're delivering the next, you know, mythical or mystical narrative.
That's right, and I think the confessional nature of a lot of fiction builds, it's again, a religious, and this book is sort of playing with that, but we ask to be absolved of our own sins as individuals in through the fiction we write, and we're sort of asking the reader to then, you know. I don't know if that's right. I feel uncomfortable sometimes with that mantle. Well,
I think one of the reasons, again, one of the things that gives this book so much power is that it doesn't make those decisions for itself. It explores all of these options, which means that you as a reader are left in the position of needing to interrogate your own decision about it, and that's very interesting. And one of the reasons that it is particularly interesting as an Australian reader is that where Vita is dealing with the history of South Africa, this is a book in a sense about a kind of wash-up of colonialism. And so that is a very interesting book to read from an Australian perspective as well. It's you mentioned before that term beneficiaries that comes from the Ugandan academic Mahmoud Mamdani, who divides, you know, the survivors of apartheid into the perpetrators, the victims and the beneficiaries. And I'm really interested in how you've spoken about the difficulty of writing from the place of the beneficiary, because writing often needs us, you say, you know, so much of the power of literature comes from witnesses, from having the sense of being wronged. Now that makes it's a very sort of subtle interplay in this book, but it's part of what gives all of the characters, Vita and Royce, Kitty, who's the character that, you know, you mentioned in the section that you read, who was someone of Royce's era, but then the psychotherapist that Vita ends up working with herself. All of these people are kind of walking around that sort of idea of witness as well. Can you talk a little bit more about the ways that you hoped those ideas might press up against readers, not to say, you know, you wanted the book to do a certain moral job, but just the kind of interface that you wanted to open up between those ideas and how readers would come into them?
That's such a great question. I think, again, it comes back to, you know, finding the right language to have these conversations. Mm. So, for example, you know, a term like white guilt, we don't really go beyond, you know, we don't really try and dig deeper with what that term might mean. For me, the really useful thinking behind what white guilt is, what complicity is, you know, what you can say when you are coming from a sort of, you know, privileged place, all goes back to J.M. Coetzee, the South African and now Australian author and Nobel Prize winner, because he was way before many other white South African authors of his generation, he was really suspicious of what the self-flagellating impulse of the, you know, white liberal, what else was happening there? Mm. What other kind of identity was that person enacting by professing their guilt? And he, you know, was critical of a trend in white South African writing at that time where, you know, by asking somebody to absolve you of your sins, that's a kind of moral neediness on the part of the perpetrator. So you're doing another kind of violence on the person that you've wronged. He uses Derrida's term, I think, circumfession, that in any confession there's something that's still, there's something you're going around.
Around, yeah.
And a lot of that fiction, which again, I guess I'm sort of in conversation with that tradition, is around a kind of autobiographical abjection. So you are prostrating yourself, saying, I'm so bad. But at the same time, you're saying, look at me, I'm so bad.
Yes. this is about me.
Yeah, and that goes back to Freud's idea of narcissism being, you know, there's two sides to it. There's self-love, but the other side of it is self-hate.
Mm.
So I don't know what to make of all of that, but certainly just, again, in understanding my own feelings about these things and trying to parse how that might lead to how you act in the world, that's useful to kind of think of it like, oh, what am I asking for in having to, you know, spill this stuff? Like, what is this evacuation of guilt? What else is it doing, you know, for me?
And all those, you know, all those ambiguities and ambivalences are just so palpable in here. And I'm really glad that you mentioned Coetzee because I would like to talk about him a little bit. And I'm conscious of the time as well to give you time to ask Keridan your questions. But you have another book coming later this year, which is for the Black Ink series, Writers on Writers, and you're writing about Coetzee there. And when I was reading In the Garden of the Fugitives, it took me a while to realise, but sometimes I could feel his echo. I could sort of feel, you know, some sense of him. And so I wondered if he was, how his work worked on you as a writer, and if he was someone who you carried very consciously on your shoulder, whether that was, you know, something that informed all of your work, or whether he was a different kind of accompaniment in the making of this book.
Yeah, I mean, he is... the psychoanalytic framework actually makes sense too when it comes to his influence on me, because my mum was one of the first literary critics to write on his work, so this was in the early 80s. And so she was breastfeeding me when Waiting for the Barbarians came out, 1980. And if you've read it, it's an awful, violent... I mean, it's a wonderful book, but it's... violent, it's raping and murdering and pillaging and raping again, and so the way that I begin this, it's a short book on Coetzee, but is with this sense, a very Lacanian sense, and psychoanalysis is always that theory has always fed into Coetzee's work, and my mum's whole lens of reading his body of work was through those same theorists. They were kind of both coming out of a French theory binge, and so she was incredibly intellectually stimulated by what he was doing with the theory and then using it to deconstruct these modes of white writing. I still don't totally understand what she does with his work, and I'm very open about it in the essay, but that I almost feel a little bit like I got him in the breast milk. Like, it was, you know...
there was no escape for
him. Yeah, like, he's in me. And then over the course of, you know, growing up, some of my most vivid memories are of seeing the covers of his books lying around, you know, and Mum was doing that thing of, you know, she's trying to do her PhD in post-colonial literature and raise a family, and so it would be, you know, in a very domestic setting. They would be, you know, in the heart of the country, which has this horrific green witch with her head put on backwards in the original edition, and, you know, very striking images. And I knew there was something in these books that was taking my mother to another place. And I wasn't envious. It wasn't that sense of, you know, the children scratching on the door to be let in. But I wanted to know where she was going. I could see her fall through the trapdoor into this other world, and I wanted to follow. And so I think at some level, the only way I could do that was to try to become a writer myself and experience it from the inside.
It makes for this amazing kind of triangulation, doesn't it, between, you know, between three different voices and two different generations and all that sort of...
Totally. And that's, you know, the sense in psychoanalysis of taking the third position, so that any child has to learn, one of the first things it has to learn is to make space in the relationship, the bond between the mother and child, for the fact that the mother has relationships with other people. You know, it's sort of a necessary step in maturation. And sometimes I wonder if, like, I learned through him and her engagement with him. She was totally, you know, focused and loving with us too. But I feel like, in a way, watching her passion for his work enabled me to understand that she was a woman with a life of the mind, and that was very inspiring and powerful as a young girl to see.
Absolutely. I'm going to see if anybody else would like to ask Keridan a question.
I haven't read any of your books. I had never heard of you before now, so sorry if this is silly, but it sounds like you spend a lot of time in a very empathic and quite intense emotional place with this book, feeling sad for people so, so long ago. And I wondered whether you felt that you wanted to write something really, really light next. Instead of, I don't know, because I don't know, maybe you don't write books like that, but I wondered if you wanted to just think, oh, next book will just be a light, happy place. I don't know.
No, great question. Thank you. I've realised from many, many failed projects, and actually my publisher's sitting there and he can attest to this, I have two modes of writing. And when I try to do happy, funny, it's a disaster. So I feel like I'm trapped in this dark place. I don't know if I want to be there, but I don't know what it is. But yeah, I've just come to see at the beginning of each project, I can see I've got to make a conscious choice which way I'm going to go. And unfortunately, the darkness always wins.
But also, I would say in defence of, you know, you're not living entirely in a dark hole somewhere, because part of what is so wonderful, so Keridan's previous book was a fantastic short story collection called Only the Animals, which was, you know, taking certain historical moments and telling that, you know, sort of retelling them in a sense through, you know, there was a mussel who'd been caught up in the attack on Pearl Harbor, and there's the bear who dies in the conflict in Bosnia-Herzegovina. There's a naval dolphin working in Iraq who writes to Sylvia Plath. You know, this is this is still interested in the project of giving voices to other points of view in history, but not perhaps as, you know.
Thanks, Ash.
That's okay. I'm just going to leap to defence there.
And I think everyone's very relieved that I moved on from the dead animals.
I loved the dead animals. I thought they were wonderful.
Someone said to me the other day, are you going to do another
dead
series?
Animal book?
Dead animals, 19th century, you know? And I saw the look across my mother's face and I thought, definitely not. But I guess, yes, that's true. It's not just the darkness. There is meant to be something a little bit playful, I suppose, in these books. So, I mean, there's a scene in here that everyone's been very kind not to mention, but where Vita accidentally deletes her own film because she's having shenanigans with the boy and she sits on the keyboard and her bum sort of accidentally presses the delete key, you know. And no one's brought it up because I think really they want to know, did that really happen?
Yeah, that's the question we're not going to ask you. We're being really polite about that fiction biography divide, I think,
You know, when you look at a novel like Too Late, the Fella Rope, it uses psychological power, but not the conventional way. Whereas, you know, your email exchange, did you think of other ways of actually writing it in a more traditional sense?
Good question too. No, for some reason it just, right from the beginning, was these two, you know, voices, these kind of counter voices, and it, you know, obviously changed a lot, and we spent a whole year editing it, like to really make sure it was that tension stayed between them. But for some reason, no, I don't think I could have written it in any other way, and I didn't start a certain way, and then something Chris Krauss, the I Love Dick lady, says about also the letter form is that you don't have to do. It explains why these characters are speaking. Mm. You know, in any other book, the first thing you've got to do is that suspension of disbelief that you ask any reader to make. Like, why is this person
telling me this,
you know? You actually escape that problem, which is a craft problem, because it's immediately apparent why they're writing. They're writing to somebody else, and then that person is writing back. So, again, there was sort of a freedom in terms of the craft of it that I didn't have to do any of the throat clearing that happens often at the beginning of a novel of, like, come with me and it'll be worth it, but you will be confused for a while why this story is being told.
And it also changes how you talk about everything, because, you know, setting is different.
Yes.
You know, the kind of possibilities and functions of all the other characters are different, because everything is, you know, once you know what these two voices are saying, that dictates a lot of what you're doing in terms of the mechanics of making the story.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's also a handy way of avoiding writing dialogue, which I really don't like doing. So, you know, the letter form is always retrospective, right? Mm-hmm. So recalling stuff that's happened in the past, whether the immediate past or the distant past, so you can really move between that stuff, but there's not a lot of... There's not scenes where these people are having to say dialogue in real time. And for me, that was, an intentional avoidance.
Evasion. There's one more question, and I think that's probably all we're going to have time for. Yep.
I was just wondering, was there... Sorry.
directly behind.
Was there a particular point, say, when you realised you wanted to be a writer and not just realised that, but committed to that path? And was there a particular reason for that?
Yes, I fell into it a little bit. I had wanted to be a filmmaker first and then a social anthropologist ethnographer making sort of fly-on-the-wall observational documentaries. And I'd always loved literature and all that, but I also had a sense that it was my mum's thing and I wanted to do something a little bit different and also to be forced to look out into the world at that stage in my life. I felt like writing fiction was all about, you know, curling up and looking at the contents of your own mind, and I just didn't have much in there yet. So I had a sense, I think, that I needed to be forced to engage with these other bodies of knowledge and have these outward-looking experiences and lurk around other people's lives, eavesdrop on their experience, so that, you know, maybe one day I would have something to say. But it took a long time, I think, to feel legitimate. I've always... usually had another thing going on in my life. So partially, I think, so that I, kind of didn't feel like I had committed to it, but also to keep it feeling a little bit illicit. Like, for me to write well with the fiction, I have to feel a bit like I'm getting away with something. It should feel a bit dirty. And secretive, and I suppose really private, just for me, you know. You never think when you're writing that anybody else is going to read it, even after you've been published, you know. It's like some conversation you're having with yourself, and you have to kind of keep it that way. Those were all my strategies, I think, of sort of sneaking up on the identity without being like, I'm a writer, because then it would change my relationship to why I wanted to do it. So, yeah, even now I'm about to actually go speak at a Stella panel where we're all going to speak about how we work across different forms. So I really love writing nonfiction essays, and then obviously the toggling between the short stories and novels. So yeah, I think all of that stuff is okay to sort of be still open to what kind of creative identity you might want to have.
Thank you for that question. We've come to the end of our time with Keridan this morning. I wanted to thank all of you again for coming along. Readers are an incredibly important part of the process of writing because we need you at the end of what we're doing. As I said, you'll find Keridan outside briefly. I think the signing table's to the right and she'll be there for a little while before they whisk her off for her next panel if you would like to keep talking with her. But most importantly, can I ask you to join me now in thanking Keridan Dovey for her fantastic conversation this morning?
Thank you.
Thank you.